invite technicians like you guys and gals to basically come on the show and share what you're doing in your business so that we all can, as a group, can learn. And I've been doing that for over a year now and been having a lot of fun with it. I get to talk to a lot of different technicians, a lot of computer business owners, and it's been, you know, wonderful to hear all the different things that people are doing, and it always has sparked ideas in me to make my business better, and I'm always looking to make my business better, and so that's why we do what we do, and it's also to bring the community together so that we all can share and hopefully learn things and, you know, move our businesses forward. Because one of the things that I've really found in this business is that a lot of people will get to a certain point where you go, is this business actually worth it? And you'll get to the point where you go, I don't think it's worth it anymore. I'm working too much. I'm not making enough. And it gets very frustrating. And a lot of us have felt, you know I have, for years that you're just standing out there by yourself. And there's nobody to talk to. There's nobody to help. And so that's why I really like this community. And even before I started hosting these shows over on the Podnuts Network, I had listened to these shows since, I think, late 2008, and I've always learned something from the newest technician to a technician that's been in the business for over 20 years. And so I will tell you right up front, I do not have all the answers, because there are a lot of things that I'm doing in my business right now that I've learned a lot of things, and there's a lot of things that I still want to implement in my business, but I am constantly moving forward in my business to make it better. So with that being said, I talk to a lot of people and they've given me a lot of ideas. So hopefully I can bring some of that stuff out today, and hopefully we can answer these questions and get you guys some good answers or good conversation to at least, you know, lead you in the right direction.
Awesome. Thank you, Jeff. We have some questions that people submitted before the webinar started. So I'll start with those, but if you guys have questions that you think of while we're going, feel free to submit them in the question box there, and I'll just relay them to Jeff. So the first question here is from Aaron, and he says, how do you effectively advertise to get new residential clients when you're on a budget?
That's a great question, and it's one of those questions that gets brought up all the time. And I will tell you that I'm in a probably – not everybody does what I do. But I went and somebody taught me how to use Google AdWords when I first started officially charging for my business in 2010. And I've been using Google AdWords ever since. I've used it in two different areas and the response is about the same. You know, it costs probably about $20 a customer, which a lot of people are going to think that's pretty high. The thing is I will tell people that I've never spent a dime of my own personal money. It's always come out of the business. So even when you're starting off, if you can, you know, just take that month, and a lot of times you can get to like $100 free from Google AdWords through like HostGator or some of these other, you know, companies. There's all kinds of coupon codes out there. I get about two a year from different companies saying, hey, you know, we'll give you $100 to start a Google AdWords account. And so I encourage a lot of people to, you know, to look into that, to set that up. The thing is, you have to set it up properly, and you can't just throw caution to the wind, and you have to kind of think about how to set it up properly and how to, you know, how far you're willing to travel and not just advertise everywhere. Because one time I clicked the wrong button on a Google AdWords, and I was basically transmitting my ad to the whole United States. And it, in about 1 hour's time, it cost me about $300. So now it's not, I don't think you can do that the same way anymore, but this was when Google AdWords was fairly new. So I still use Google AdWords today. I know there are people that are talking about using Craigslist, you know, things like that in your local area, which I think is great for local. What I caution people is when you're using Craigslist, is that you make an ad that basically will, you don't want to be the cheap guy on Craigslist. Let me put it that way. You want to charge a fair rate, but maybe even boost it up a little bit higher, because you're looking for the right type of, you know, person to basically come into your business, and it's going to be willing to pay you not only this time, but is also going to be willing to come back and is not just looking for that one-off deal and not the person that's going to cause you constant problems. So there's Craigslist. I think I've heard some of the guys have talked about actually, you get these little local, I don't even know what they're called, like little magazines from the restaurant, that'll have, different advertisements in there. Those are fairly inexpensive to put a little quarter page ad. I've done that before in another business, not this one. And, we were generating phone calls off that. I think in today's day and age, a lot of people are really looking to support local businesses. One of the other things I do is we go to a meat store. I don't necessarily just get all my meat from Meijer, Kroger, whatever. And at that meat store, because the local farmer that has this meat store, they're like, hey, go ahead and put your business cards out on the table, among all these others. And when people come in here, they're buying meat and stuff, and they can grab a business card. And if they ever need computer repair, they're more than willing to call. So those are just some of the things that I do. And those are free, it's just really about talking to people. They're like, hey, can I put my business card here? Some of the, depending on where you live, I mean, there has always been, like, Meijer's has always had, I don't know that they do it anymore, but they used to have like a bulletin board where you could pin up, advertisements, and it's only going to be the cost of, printing something nice on your computer and basically putting it up, at these different locations within your area. So, those are some of the cheaper ways to basically start off with advertising. Google AdWords can be expensive, but at the same time, I always made my money back even within that first month. So you just have to be aware of that. And also, I mean, I wasn't the cheapest guy, but I wasn't the most expensive guy either. So, it has worked with a good median price where I was able to compensate. I think back then I was charging $79. And so, $20 off of that, but when you're getting started, it's still not bad. It still puts you in a positive.
Yeah, if I could add to that, we do AdWords as well. And I think that if you're just getting started with that, first of all, it is worth noting, like Jeff said, that you can waste a lot of money if you don't properly set up your AdWords very, very easily and very quickly. So one thing that I did when we were starting to do AdWords is I went to Barnes & Noble's, and there was a Barnes & Noble's that had a Starbucks in it. So I went and got a cup of coffee, and then I went to the marketing section, and I found 3 books on AdWords, and I just read them. And I didn't buy them or anything. I just read the books. And when we set up our AdWords campaign, I knew a lot more than I would have if I hadn't done that. And then after I kind of had it going and I saw a little bit of success, then we hired a consultant. It was like $150 an hour. All I had him do was do like 2 hours, and it was worth it because he went in there and tweaked everything to the point where we actually ended up saving a lot of money in the long run because it was more effective. So you can get started on your own. Just be careful. You can do things at a small amount. But at a certain point, once you get statistically significant data, then you can start to kind of maybe work with a consultant in order to optimize things. Okay, cool. So another question here. Is social media marketing effective in this industry for anyone you know? I do it, even though I don't like it, and I've gotten little from it so far.
So, yes, it is effective for some people. And I think that when you're talking about social media marketing, people are talking about, you make a Facebook page, a business page, you're on, LinkedIn, you have a Twitter that you might use for, tweeting stuff out, and maybe you link these things to your website so that your customers can click on them, and if they're using Twitter or Facebook or whatever, they can get to those sites. I think a lot of time, and don't get me wrong, I don't do this effectively yet, but one of the things that I want to do here in the near future is on my Facebook page for my business, I want to do this also on my website. I want to make a blog. And here's what you want to do. You want to give free content that will help the customer out. A lot of us want to hold everything back, and we don't realize that a lot of times if you help the customer out with simple things, trying to keep them safe, letting them know good, good practices and stuff like that, then they're going to be more likely when, their computer basically blows up to come to you, and they're not really going to care what you charge them to get it back to the state that it was in, because they're more than happy because they know that you're a nice person that has basically helped them out with these simple things, and you're not just charging for everything. And here's a nice thing about social media. It's not a one-on-one. So basically, you're putting a post out there that says, you know, hey, you know, Patch Tuesday is coming up, or hey, there's this type of scam going on. If somebody calls you from Microsoft, it's a scam. Don't answer or just hang up on that person and move along. And then if they do get on your computer, you know, give me a call so that I can take a look at your computer and make sure that it's not, you know, they didn't get in there or do anything nefarious, which happens often, unfortunately. People always call me after the fact. I don't understand. I've told them, hey, if you see anything, call me right away. So I think social media from that aspect is good. And you can, you know what, it doesn't really take that long to do it, but I'm guilty of, you know, not taking the time to put something together and put something on there. But I know that other people have done that, and it's working well for them. You know, they're getting enough business. And again, if you look at it from a standpoint of it's free, you know, kind of sometimes you get what you pay for, but at the same time, think about where a lot of people are at. Facebook is one of them. And I think, too, also, I've never done this, you know, but because my friends and family pretty much know that I fix computers. If they have a problem, they call me, you know, we set it up or whatever. But there's a lot of times that maybe people that you're friends with on there, you haven't seen in a while or whatever. You know what? Give that free advice even in your main stream on Facebook, and that way you're helping real people out there. They see that. And then in the back of their mind, if they think about if they need a computer fixed, the chances are Jeff helped me with this problem, I remember, or he puts posts up all the time that help me. I'm going to go ahead and call him and use his business versus going down to the street to somebody else. So.
Awesome. Yeah. I would also like to add to that that we do Facebook advertising on top of the social network, social media stuff that we do. And it's very, very effective, and as long as you make sure that you target your advertising so that it's only being shown to the demographic that you want, it can actually be very cost-effective as well. So, we have another question here. What are your top three ad or marketing strategies that work for your business?
Top three. Well, I don't know that there's an actual top three. I will tell you one of the things that, and this is just something that I'm trying this year. And, you know, I to be honest with you, I don't know if it's going to work or not. But what I'm going to do is I'm actually going to, and there's a person that through the Podnest community that does it fairly inexpensively. I'm going to do advertising on the windows of my vehicle using a mesh wrap style. And I used to use the magnets, but quite honestly, the magnets are just too small for my vehicle, and they're not real prominent. So what I'm going to do is I want to add on, you know, these basically a moving billboard on the sides and back of my vehicle to advertise my business wherever I drive or wherever my wife drives. And so that's one of the things I'm going to do. The other thing I'm going to do this year is I bought some polo shirts with my logo on them, and I basically am going to wear those when I'm out and about. And, you know, wear those obviously on customer jobs and moving from point A to point B. And just to have, again, just that little bit of advertisement out there. It's not that expensive. You know, we all go do things all the time. So a lot of times you might have somebody, oh, that's kind of cool. Oh, you fix computers or whatever. It kind of brings those conversations up, you know, if you're getting your car worked on or things like that. Something to drive the conversation. You know, like I said before, my number one right now, which brings in 60% of my business, is still Google AdWords. So that's what I use for my marketing. And, you know, the other thing is to have a clean website that you organically add good content to. I think, and we were talking about this a little bit earlier, but doing a blog on your, you know, that's going to help your customer base and, you know, help with the search results for your web page. And you know what? Have a nice, clean-looking web page, not something that's got, you know, tons of information that most people are not going to read. The only thing I really care as far as marketing on my website is I want to make sure that my number is prominent when you go to my website. Really what I want people to do is I want them to call me, because there's a contact form on there and people can get a hold of me that way. But a lot of times what I've found is that if I actually talk to the person, and we can build a rapport over the phone. And most of us know that you can really know somebody within a few minutes of conversation of whether they're trustworthy or not, for the most part. That's not always true, but for the most part. So that's one of the things that, you know, I strive for people to call me. My number is probably, you know, I want to talk to the person. So that's part of my marketing strategy, I guess. I hope that all makes sense.
Okay, cool. We got another question here from Josh. He says, I have been building my business in Virginia for almost a year. I'm getting married soon and want to move to Atlanta. What should I be doing to prepare to move my business to a new city? Secondly, should I begin marketing in Atlanta before moving, or is that putting the cart before the horse? Thanks a lot.
Great question. I think, so I moved from one, I didn't move states, but I moved from one side of the state to the middle of the state, basically. Like I said, it was an hour away. And basically what I did was I did a clean break. I shut my business down in the area. And believe it or not, it's funny because I still had people calling me 4 years later, you know, asking for, you know, for their computer to be repaired, but I didn't support that area anymore because I stick to the local areas. So I had moved, and I basically, because you're getting, you know, especially because you're getting married, and this is just my opinion, I've been married for over 25 years, that's a new experience, and, you know, probably moving, that's another huge experience. I've done that several times. I think it's easiest to concentrate on getting yourself set up in your home, getting things ready to go. And I think I probably had shut my business down for, it might have almost been 6 months. And then what I did was I opened my Google AdWords account back up and made some readjustments to the new area. I had gotten some, you know, business cards, obviously, with my new address and stuff on there. Now, I will say this. I don't know if this is your sole income. You know, if it is, then you might need to take a different approach. This was not my sole income, so I was able to do that. But if this is your sole income, you know, maybe you want to start advertising, you know, right when you first get there. I don't know that you could do it beforehand because unless you're doing like 100% remote support, it's probably not a very viable option to be able to, you know, take care of those people in that area. So that's my 2 cents on it. I don't have the experience of moving, you know, from state to state or anything like that. And I don't have the experience of this was my only income at the time when I made that move.
Nice. We have a question from Eli. What's the best way to leave notes on a ticket? I'm not sure if that's, it might be for me, but I'm not sure. Eli, would you mind elaborating? Sorry. Elaborating on what you mean?
I think when I read that, I was, I basically was thinking about how I leave notes. And I will tell you from a standpoint of me starting in my business, I would do like a lot of us do. I did have a contract that I had the customer sign. But after they signed that contract, I just grabbed the computer and just started working on it. And now that I use a ticketing system with notes and things, in there, what I do, but again, I'm holding the bag. I'm doing everything in my own business. What I do is as I'm working on a computer, I use Repair Shopper, full disclosure. And what I do is, as I'm working on a computer, I will put things in there in the notes section for what I'm doing, especially because it communicates, it emails things out to the customer. And so I found that very effective in letting the customers don't call and bother me and go, hey, when's this going to be fixed? What's going on with this? Now they have a way that they can actually look at that stuff. But it was a process of me to stop myself while I'm repairing, while I'm doing a diagnostic, to actually put the stuff, you know, take 2 seconds to sit down on my computer and type the stuff in that said, you know, this is what I found, here's what we need to do, you know, that type of thing. But that's, you know, that's pretty much going to be on your own. So it's something you have to force yourself to do if you're not used to doing it.
Yeah, if I could add to that, I do think that having a CRM is very helpful in your shop. Making sure that you have processes in place. This is how we fix computers. This is what we want every technician to do on every repair. Standardizing the whole thing is very helpful. However, in terms of notes, it's kind of a combination of things. Yes, you want high-level notes, and you should be taking those, and using Repair Shopper is a great way to do that. at the same time, you can't really expect all those logs and everything to be really, like, translated into written writing. So that's kind of why people generate reports using TextSuite or whatever on top of using the notes on Repair Shopper. So it's a combination. You got to get good tools that allow your techs to effectively take notes, and then you also have to have processes in place for doing so.
And let me add to that too. Yeah, I just saw his question. The add to the question, he was talking about. I mean, getting my techs to do it. Here's so anytime when you're in a situation where you have technicians that are working for you, obviously you're the boss, right? And so, but you can't expect people to know what to do by osmosis. It doesn't work that way. So basically what I would do in that situation for myself is I would make up some sort of process and maybe even with a code sheet that says for this type of problem, you know, write it this way. You know, hard drive. So everything is consistent and everybody is doing the same. You know, hard drive is, you know, not working or whatever. And you can make those things up. Yes, it does take time to do that, but that is probably what I would do so that everybody's on the same page, because I can't just expect people. I've seen notes and I've had different people that have, you know, that have worked with me, and basically their notes are way different than in how I do things. I'm a little more thorough when it comes to that. So if you want something as thorough that everybody can understand in your business, you definitely have to set that up ahead of time and, you know, give that expectation out to your employees to let them know, here's what I need you to do and here's how I need you to do it. So again, put those processes in place and, you know, help them, you know, be able to do it the way that you want it done.
Yeah, I think that's great advice. The thing is, standard operating procedures seem like they're a huge pain, and they seem like, you know, the man telling you what to do, but actually once you implement them, it's liberating because you don't have to think about anything.
Right.
You just do it the way that you guys agreed it was supposed to be done, and you don't have to put in any extra mental power to make it happen.
Yep, so, absolutely.
That's great advice. We got a question here from Jeff. Ian, this question is for you. When is the new version coming out? I'm assuming you mean TechWaru. The new version of TechWaru is being tested right now. I'm really excited about it. It's going to be a really cool update, and it's got a lot of cool stuff in it. Hopefully it'll be released today, actually.
Nice.
We are waiting on some feedback from some of our test users, and if we don't get anything by noon, we're just going to release it. So we'll see what happens there. Got a question here from Audrey. I recently transitioned from home to shop. I'm on the fly most of the time since we've also added small business services. One challenge is to duplicate my repair or diagnostic processes in my shop help. Any thoughts on how to carry that out in a time-friendly, effective way?
Well, I think you have probably the perfect tool for that, right, Ian? if I'm understanding the question correctly.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I would say you basically just need to standardize your repair process.
Yeah.
You need to figure out exactly. I mean, regardless of if you use our tool or not, of course our tool helps with that. But even if you don't use our tool, the main thing I would say is you need to figure out what you want your technicians to do, so it sounds like you already have your repair process. Document that, and then find a way for them to be able to reproduce it. So
right.
That means that, you know, again, even if you don't use our software, you can have a little USB drive or something that you give to all your technicians that has all the tools on it. You give them a checklist. In this scenario, you use this checklist. In this scenario, you use this checklist. And you can, you know, you can have them all on the same sheet of paper, but I would say standardization is really where it's at in terms of making your technicians more effective and empowering them to do things better.
Because, you know, from a certain standpoint, you want to have the standardization, right? So it gives you a starting point. The second part of that, though, is that you want your technicians to have the troubleshooting skills to, if that doesn't work, I need to go beyond that. So you can make that as in-depth as you need to. A lot of us, we'll just, myself included, we'll shoot from the hip. And basically we go, oh, this is the problem. Let me move on to this next step. But even for the one-person shop, I think a lot of times I'm guilty of this, and I complain all the time to my wife that I don't have these processes, you know, on paper. And I do have them on paper. I just never use them. So I need to pull those out and, you know, and stick to what I'm doing, because eventually as I'm growing and I pull other people on into my business, what I want to do is be able to hand them a sheet of paper, whether it be my, you know, 17-year-old kid or, you know, somebody off the street, and say, follow this process each and every time. You know, if it goes outside of that, then, you know, then we can talk. But I think also you have to leave that availability to, even if you're out on the road, you know, supporting a lot of businesses, you have to have that availability to where you're able to communicate with your technicians if they get stuck with something. And, you know, but if you have the basics, at least we ran through all the basics, here's what we did, and here's the point we got to. And that way, it's going to also help you be on the same page with your technicians to know what has already been done, instead of going through the same checklist in your mind again. Did you do this? Did you do that? Did you do this? You know, and so again, it comes back down to having that process sheet and actually using it, whether you're a one-person shop or you're a shop with, you know, employees.
Yeah, that's a great point. And Audrey followed that up with a question that says, do you use checklists then? And I would say everybody has a checklist, whether it's in their head or on paper. It should probably be on paper. But everybody does have a checklist, I would say. You know, like Jeff said, a lot of times you're shooting from the hip. And I think it's a matter of, if you're a more experienced technician, a lot of times there's some intuition there. But for your newer technicians, I think that it is more viable to encourage them to use a checklist.
Well, and I'll say this too. Okay, so how many of us out there have basically gotten to the point where we go, hey, we've done a virus removal on a computer, and we've updated all this stuff, and then, you know, we close the computer up, we print the invoice out, we're ready to go, and we go, did I update Flash? I can't remember if I updated Flash. You know, because maybe we're not using an automated tool that does Flash or whatever. That's just one scenario. But I think even from our standpoint, I do that so many times that I kick myself and go, you know what? I have the checklist. I just need to pull the checklist out, maybe make some tweaks to them. So even to be honest with you, to standardize your process, I would even use a checklist. Even though I'm guilty, I don't do it all the time. It's one of the things that I know that I need to get to and do it in my business. Because if not, you know, you're working on five computers at one time, and you don't remember what you did from one computer to another. Even when you're working on one computer at a time and you get distracted with other things in life, sometimes you don't remember exactly what you did, you know, because obviously, you know, you're doing a virus removal or something like that, you're not sitting there watching the computer. You know, you're doing something else. And then you come back and you go, oh yeah, I got to do this. And then you know, but if you had a checklist that you could attach to that computer, and this is one of the things I will do, then you can basically, you know, check that next box off. Now, a lot of people will think that that's, you know, kind of a pain or whatever, but I will tell you that, again, like Ian said, it frees your mind up to think about other things. Because you're just going through a process. Instead of using brain power in your head, you can be working on something else in your business, and you can basically just go over and go, okay, next. Okay, I did that. Boom. And you're just checking it off. It's very simple, even for us that have been doing this for a long time.
Great points. Mike asks, how do you go about finding new suppliers and evaluating them? I find it hard to find reliable suppliers for many older or niche parts for laptops.
Oh, that is an age-old question. I had once said to – I've talked to a couple technicians and said, man, if there was a way to somehow get these parts from, you know, wherever overseas and warehouse them here and make distribution centers for these types of parts for, you know, like kind of like what Amazon does, but just for computer repair parts, that would be awesome. Problem is, we don't have that. And to be honest with you, I have not found a supplier in the area that basically that I've been able to talk to. So, you know, my process for laptop repair parts has always been eBay. There are some other, you know, there are some other businesses out there that I bought motherboards from and different things like that. And off the top of my head, I can't remember the names of them. But it was while I was searching for a certain, you know, motherboard part number, and I came across another site that actually had the motherboard. But as far as having something all in one place that you can go to every time, nothing like that I found over the years actually exist to a point where I know 100% of the time I can go there and they're going to have that part. I just had to order a digitizer overseas, and because there's no supplier that I could find in the United States that had this particular digitizer for an HP laptop. So 21 days later, I'm getting my package from Hong Kong, and that was all I could do. So it's unfortunate, but I don't really have a great answer for, you know, getting the all-in-one supplier.
It's a really interesting question. We used to have a Google custom search engine that we built that helped you find parts, and it was on Tech Portal, and people didn't use it that much. But that being said, we didn't have that many customers at the time. And it was a while back, and it's interesting because maybe we ought to put that on computerrepairsoftware.com.
It might be helpful.
Be able to use.
Right.
Yeah, definitely. Cool. Let's see here. Got a question from Ron. I don't have a business, but have been toying with the idea of starting a computer spec or build business. However, while I can do computer repair, I'm nowhere near as fast as it seems companies seem to be, and my wife would kill me if I wasn't home for the kids so much. Would you have ideas for trying to start a business? For example, looking into some sort of partnership with a remote support tech team be worth looking into, or a local shop or something. The more advanced break fix just isn't a strong point and or becomes very time consuming. Basic bad hardware, setting up software is fine, just the serious server settings, virus removal, etc. just isn't really something I'd be comfortable spending 8 hours in front of a customer. Any ideas, pointers, etc.?
Wow, that's a great loaded question. I will tell you, Ron, that, you know, you can start off in this business at any, you know, as much time as you want to put into it. So in other words, you gotta look at the amount of money that you're spending. Obviously, you want that return on investment, not only for the time that you're spending, but also the money you've invested. So if you're using, like, you know, a remote support tech team is a great service. They can do the white label support for you. They do a lot of stuff, you know, they do their stuff remotely. They can handle your customer calls and different things like that. It's a great service. There is a cost for doing that. If you're comfortable with paying that cost and turning that around and using it as a business for yourself, then that's fine. You know, you can spend as little or as much time in the business as you want. And what I mean by that is there are, if you look at three ways of basically doing business, you know, there'll be shops out there that are quick. We're the 24-hour turnaround people. There will be shops out there that are, you know, they're cheap, for lack of better words. They're inexpensive. They're lower than everybody else. So but they might take longer to do it. And then there's the shops that are, you know, they're more towards the quality end. So in other words, it doesn't matter. You're going to pay a premium, but it really doesn't matter how long I am going to, you know, work on this computer. We'll get it back to you eventually. You know, and what I mean by that is I used to be the 24-hour turnaround person. And then what I figured out was that just drove me crazy because I'm sitting there working a full-time job, working a part-time computer repair business, and I'm running around all the time trying to make sure that this stuff gets back to the customer the next day. And, you know, not seeing my family or not doing anything with them, and that became very frustrating. So what I did was I said, no, you know what I'm going to do? Number one, I'm going to raise my prices because it's going to give me the right type of customer. And then if I don't have any business, that's fine. But, you know, the right type of customer that's willing to pay my rates comes in, and I go, you know, it'll be, 24 to 48, sometimes even 72 hours. It just depends. You know, if I don't run into anything weird, then, you know, we can probably get it back to you in 48 hours, but I don't try to do the quick anymore. And out of those three scenarios that I gave you, you can only do one of them well. You know, and a lot of people will try to do all three, and you can't. It's just an impossibility. So from that standpoint, I would say that if you don't mind spending a little bit of money and you want to start off with a white label service, absolutely. You know, go ahead and do something like that. I think a lot of times, though, you can charge a rate or even start working on friends and family's computers, you know, maybe even for a reduced rate where you just kind of do it at your leisure. And you kind of learn in the process as you're going. So I think that's one of the things out there that, you know, we've all started off with that, you know, starting with friends and family where, you know, we may or may not charge them. You know, my family usually paid something. And I would go in there, and that was my learning process. And I would, you know, work on a computer and get it fixed and go, oh, okay, that's how that's done. And so, you know, that didn't take a whole lot of time because I could work on it at my leisure. But that's a choice that you have to make in your business. Are you going to get a business that you're just going to start and is going to go, you know, bananas and just, you know, start pulling in all kinds of revenue right away? Not that I know of. Not that it's not, you know, not that it's impossible. I've just never seen it. It's usually there's a learning curve to doing business, and there's a lot of, you know, time and effort that goes into, you know, learning how to do things and learning how to do them better. But that's the way I would start off is just, like I said, friends and family, learn at your own pace, you know, and then also segment your time. I've had to do this with between podcasting, my computer repair business, and my full-time job. I had to segment my time to what I was willing, okay, here's what I'm willing to spend in my business on a daily basis, and that's it. And you have to go, if you're not done with the problem, you're done, and you move on to it the next day. You know, so, but that's kind of all personal preferences, and you have to figure out exactly where you're at and what it is you want to do and kind of what your end game is so that you can move in that direction. I hope that helps.
Nice. Okay, we have a question here from, I hope I'm pronouncing this right, Solifero. How much should my business be making before I hire a tech? Computers per day or income per month?
Say that question again.
Sorry. It's how much should my business be making before I hire a technician? Computers per day or income per month?
Oh gosh. That is a great question. Oh, Telefero. Okay. Yes. He's actually been on Podnets Daily before. I will tell you that you have to, I guess, and I don't know this per se from myself, but just from talking to other people in the industry, when you can't keep up is basically when you need to hire somebody. And are you going to take a drop in income at that point? From everybody that I've talked to thus far, that's pretty much what happens. But because they have more availability now, not only are they able to work on different things in their business and, you know, promote their business, market it, do whatever, but they're also able to handle more business, so they're not turning any business away. So what ends up happening is in the short term, yes, your income, your personal income will drop, but you will in a short period of time, that income starts to go back up because you're able to handle that much more. But from what I understand from everybody, that they say it's a very scary proposition the first time you hire somebody. And the only thing I can think of, and I've thought about this over the years, is that, and a lot of people will, they don't like this answer. Sometimes, if you have somebody out there that you really have good rapport with and you trust, you can subcontract. Now, a lot of people don't like to subcontract because they don't have control over that person or how they do their business. But I think if you come up with a good contract between you and that person and say, here's how I want you, you know, I understand you do things your way. Here's how I want you to do this process. And it's the same way that I do my process. It's how, and here's all the checks and balances. Here's my checklist. Here's what I want done. I think if you do it in that way and the person's hungry enough to, you know, to do a good job so that they have that extra money coming in, that might be a way to start off. But, yeah, it's definitely a scary proposition. But I would say the straight answer is when you are basically turning people away and you don't have enough hours in a day to help all the customers that are coming in. Or, you know, even to a point where, you know, when you're starting to get to the point where it's, you know, it's taking, you know, a week or two to get a computer back to somebody, you know, that's probably a good time to look at, yeah, I probably need to hire somebody. And then the other thing too is you could also try hiring somebody on a part-time basis. You know, you don't necessarily, maybe you don't need them on a full-time basis. Maybe you need them a couple times a week to help clean up, you know, all the stuff that has come in, and they can help finish that process up. So I think there's a lot of different ways to do it. I don't know what the best way is. I just know that from the people I've talked to, everybody's kind of done it a little bit differently, and it's scary, but it's, for the most part, it's always worked out for people.
Yeah, if I could add to that, I think that this is a daunting concept to a lot of people, especially mostly technically minded people. But if you are willing to dive into financing, like just finances in general, and you can make a spreadsheet that says, okay, here's my profit margin on every computer repair, here's my overall cost, here's my revenue after that, that can make it so that it's not really a matter of intuition. It's like, okay, we're going to hire somebody. It makes sense to hire somebody when we get to this many computers repaired per week. And then it's just mathematical, and you don't feel the pressure of having to know if it's, you know, a good decision or not, because it just works out. And then afterwards, you can go back and check to see if the results that you thought were going to have happen after you hired that person were the actual results, or if they were off. And then you can adjust from there. Maybe you didn't actually need somebody to come in full time. Oh, our profits aren't where we thought they would be when we hired a technician. So then you just bring them in part time. And again, just like the standard operating procedures, they seem like a huge upfront pain, but in fact, it's liberating in the sense that it allows you to make a decision without thinking about it. You just use the data.
That's a very good point, Ian. And, you know, a lot of us, you know, I've been guilty of it in the past. To be honest with you, I kind of estimated what Google AdWords was costing me per customer, and I never really figured out the cost. And to be honest with you, a lot of us really don't figure out the costs in a lot of things that we do. We don't, you know, do you count your phone bill? Do you count your cable internet connection? Do you count the space that you're leasing, or, you know, even the space that you're using, or all the different tools that you pay for on a regular basis? Are you counting the cost to see what it is that you're actually, what your outgo is compared to what your income is? And I think you're right, Ian. If you get to a certain point where you're looking at that stuff and you put it down in a spreadsheet, it is just data that will point you in the right direction. I think that's a great answer.
Cool. So we have another question here from Mike. I find a lot of local shops do not list prices on their website, and sometimes not even in their shops. They make you call in to ask for prices. Do you think it benefits repair businesses to list the prices on their website, in shop, both, or neither?
That's another great question, Mike. So I've gone back and forth on some of these things. I've had, you know, prices on my website before. Here's what I found, though. When I do have prices on my website, again, my number one thing when people go to my website, the number one thing I want them to do is call me, because I want to create a dialogue with them. And because I let them call me and we talk back and forth, the number one question I always get is, how much is that going to be? It doesn't matter if I put right in their face, you know, the flat fee price that I charge, or, you know, I list out all my services. It doesn't matter. They still ask me, how much is that going to be? So when I looked at that from what I was getting from my customers, I decided that it's not that important for me to have my prices on my website for my separate services. Now, I will tell you that as far as Google AdWords, and here's something that I've done recently, probably the beginning of this year, is that I changed my ad to show my flat fee price for most fixes. So I wanted to give a price out there to let you know, before you even click on my ad, what it's going to cost. So I put that on there, and it's also on the front page of my website. You know, basically, if you bring your computer to me, here's a flat cost it's going to cost most of the time, you know, obviously outside of parts. That is really the only price I put on there. Now, I will list my services and different things that I do so people are aware of, you know, what I do. But what ends up happening is most people do not read most of the things on the website. And, you know, and quite honestly, even in a shop, when you walk into a shop and you know, they don't have prices there, again, you're going to hand them a computer and they're going to go, okay, it's going to be, they're going to look at it and go, it's going to be this much. You know, maybe they have a price list, you know, underneath the cash drawer or something, I don't know, but I don't know that it's that beneficial for somebody coming in. They just need their computer fixed. And so if they're going to look at, oh, it's going to cost me this much to do this, you know, because prices are different, right? So you have a screen repair. Now, I can tell most people that I do screen repairs for $149. That's parts and labor. And because I have a reputable person that I get, you know, on eBay, that I actually have been getting screens from for the last 5 years. And they're A-plus screens, and they work 100% of the time. I've never had a dead one, but, you know, even if you do, you can send it back, no big deal. So I think from that standpoint, I don't know. It's just, it's one of those things. I don't know that prices are that important. I can give a roundabout figure of what is a repair is going to cost, and then people decide at that point whether they want to do it or not. But I don't ever set that stuff in stone either, because you might come across something else where, oh, they need a screen repair, but, hey, this computer's not booting up because one of the RAM modules is bad. You know, so You know, and you've got to call the customer and let them know that type of thing. So I think that's why a lot of people don't actually list their prices, because depending on the situation, I think they can be very adjustable. And not necessarily in a bad way. I mean, if a person doesn't need, you know, what they thought was broken, and you can tell them, hey, you don't need that, so we can save a little bit of money here, but here's what you do need. I mean, it kind of works in their favor too. So I don't know that those are necessarily what I would call hidden prices. It's just a service industry. And it's no different than when you go to a car repair mechanic, right? They have a book that basically says a transmission repair is a five-hour job at $120 an hour plus the parts. So it doesn't matter if it takes that technician, that mechanic, 2 hours to complete that transmission rebuild, they still get charged the 5 hours because that's just what they have set in stone, and that's how they do that business. But I think in this business, I think it can be a little more adjustable than that. Than setting in stone, this is what it's going to cost every time, because let's face it, every repair is not always the same.
Great point. Ryan asks, how do you deal with a customer when after fixing their computer, something else goes wrong, maybe a day later when they get it back and they blame you, even when you didn't do anything that would cause that issue?
That is a great question, Ryan. My unknown policy, which is nowhere on my website or anything like that, and it's not something I tell my customers or anything, but, you know, number one, if a customer is not satisfied with my service for whatever reason, you know, outside of parts, I'm never going to eat parts. You know, I mean, if they want to give me the part back after I fix something and, you know, I'm going to send that part back and get my money back, but I'm more than willing to give them a refund on the labor. And so a lot of times you're doing a virus removal and something else happens, It's really hard to tell, did I cause that problem or didn't I cause that problem? Let's face it, when you're doing a virus removal, let's say, and you're fixing something, but in the process of using a certain tool, this might not have been your fault, but Windows is already corrupted to a certain point that it actually broke something in the registry, and, you know, and that needs to be fixed. And maybe it's something you didn't see at the time, you know, which happens. You know, again, it goes back to a process. Do you have a process sheet for checking to make sure everything's working? You know, that type of thing. Hey, do my Flash videos play online? Can I watch YouTube? Can I, you know, whatever. You know, there's many things that people do. Can I open up a PDF? You know, so I think if you're 100% sure that you didn't do it, you know, depending on the situation, a lot of times what I'll do is I'll just, if it's a small minor issue, I'll fix it. If it's something that's just blatantly, you know, not my fault, you know, then, you know, we might talk about, well, yeah, we can fix that, but that's not what you originally brought it in for. I'll give you a discounted rate. I'll charge you this in order to get that fixed too, since you just brought the computer in for something else. But that has nothing to do with me. So it's kind of, you got to kind of feel the situations out. I have, you know, like I said, I've got the contingency plans for if they're just really upset, you know what? Here's your money back. We don't need to be doing business anymore. I'm perfectly fine with that. Yes, it's a learning experience. I ate the cost on that. You know, maybe I need to raise my price a little bit more so I don't get those types of customers in. And I will tell you that when I did raise my prices, that a lot of those customers went away. I don't really have those problems like I used to when I was charging cheaper rates.
Good point. If I could add anything to that, it would just be that what you mentioned, the checklists and stuff. And I think the thing that's empowering about having your results of your repair in your records is that when a client comes to you and says, hey, I have this problem, you can say, look, I ran four malware scanners on your computer. These are the things I removed. I cleaned up your computer, XYZ. And then that kind of negates their, you didn't remove any malware on my computer. You can show them I ran four scanners. So having those results there at your disposal is definitely empowering. And Jesse had a question that was kind of along the same lines. How do you deal with customers that get upset because they get malware again 2 to 3 months after you clean them up? I don't know. Do you have an additional answer to that?
You know, when it comes to – so a lot of times the question I will get from customers is, number one, after I've done a cleanup for them, is they'll ask me, how do I not get affected again? And I just look at them point blank and go, I can't, there's no guarantee. I don't, you know, whatever you're doing on a computer, whether it's your fault or not, sometimes websites are infected. You know, there's a chance if your stuff is not updated that you can, you know, get reinfected again. I think, you know, 2-3 months out, it's going to be another charge. Now, if it's within, I have a 30-day, you know, labor policy. If it's within the 30 days, yeah, I'll take a look at it again. Because a lot of times, here's the thing. Once I have a good base on, like, a virus removal, right, and I put the things in place, I've updated everything, and everything's at a good spot, even if they get infected, really I can remote into the machine and have it fixed up in, you know, 5-10 minutes. I'm not going back and doing a whole virus removal again because I've already done the extensive virus removal. And so that's kind of what I do. But, yeah, 3 months out, yeah, you're going to bring it back to me. I've charged. You know, I'll charge a customer again, and then I let them know, by the way, I also have a monthly managed service that we can provide for you that will – it won't eliminate these problems 100%, but it will eradicate a lot of them. And then what I, with my service, I actually give a free, free virus removal if they do get infected. Because again, once you have a base set up for a good working computer that's getting updated all the time, it's not that hard to go back in, remote in, and clean that machine up here in 5-10 minutes, and then you're on your way. And because you're remoting in, you can do other things at the time. You're not sitting there, you know, having to watch that or babysit it.
Nice. Jacob asks, how do you effectively train staff?
that's a great question. How do you effectively train staff? 1 hour workshop forwards, okay. That's a, you know what, I don't really have a solid answer for, you know, how do you effectively train staff. I would say that, Ian, you could probably, you know, answer this a little bit better, you know, because you guys are, you know, using it, you got a team there. But I sure. Think from the standpoint of you can, it's basically, again, just getting your processes and things in order and pulling everybody together at the same time so that whatever you're giving to them at the time, everybody's hearing it identically the same. I think a lot of times if you train people separately, what will end up happening is that one person will hear one thing, another person will hear something else, and all of a sudden the other person will say, well, so-and-so didn't teach me to do it that way. They told me to do it this way. And maybe they misheard. Maybe they're used to doing things their own way, whatever. It doesn't really matter. But if you can get everybody in the same room at one time, I think that's the best way to get the message across. Plus, you're not having to repeat yourself several times.
Yeah, we keep coming back to this, but having, you know, a decision made as to how you want your repair shop run, and then having those decisions documented in such a way that a new person can go from knowing nothing to knowing your process is empowering because it enables you to train them without actually doing anything. Another thing is that just in general, in terms of team management, I usually like to sit down with people on a regular basis and talk to them about what they want to be doing in their job and what makes them satisfied every day so that I can put them in a position to enjoy what they're doing. So for some people, they might not want to do certain parts of the computer repair. Okay, fine. So put them on certain jobs and put other people on other jobs. So I think that that's another aspect that's more psychological, but understanding what your technicians like to do will maybe enable you to train them in certain things better. And again, standardizing your repair process.
Right.
And documenting things is going to be massively helpful, however you do it. Anything to add, Jeff, before we move on?
No, I was going to say, I think there was a question at the top that we kind of missed over. It's did we answer one from Jason? Do you recommend charging an hourly rate or a flat rate for repairs?
Oh, yeah, sorry, we missed that one.
And then I haven't heard the product mentioned to help with the checklist. Great points. Do I charge an hourly rate? Or an hourly rate or flat rate for repairs? Great question. And a lot of people, there's many different ways to do this. You have to do what you feel is comfortable. I will charge a flat rate for most services if you bring it to me. If I go out on site, there is a $20 trip charge each way. So in other words, I will go out, I will pick a computer up, I will bring it back, I will fix it, and bring it back out to you. So it's my, and at that point, it's my flat rate plus $40. Okay. And outside of that, and here's what a lot of people ask me. They go, well, people don't want me to take the computer with me and this, that, and the other. And I'm like, well, here's what I do. So when I go out on site, which I don't do a whole lot, I will go out on site and, you know, you're covered for basically an hour. And we're going to look at the computer and we have a couple choices. If I can get it to a working point where I need to clean some stuff up and kind of finish the process, I can go back to my office and basically remote in and finish that stuff up, no problem. That way I don't have to take the computer. If it's something that is so hosed or so bad that I need to, you know, I'm going to need to bring it back, I can usually tell that within 5 to 10 minutes. And so here's what I tell them. We can do one of two things. I have an hourly rate of $89 an hour. So we can either charge the $89 plus the $40 for the trip charge here and back. I'll take it back to my office. I'll fix it, bring it back to you, set it up for you, and we'll be good to go. And with that being said, my trip charge, you know, being $20, I basically don't go out of a 6-mile radius. I have 93,000 people in a 6-square-mile radius in this area, so I'm not really concerned about driving out past that. So that's kind of what I charge there. But a lot of times people will go, if they want you to stay, that's fine. It's going to be $89 an hour past this first hour. You know, it's $89 for the first hour and so on and so forth. And this job's probably going to take me 4 hours. At that time, I've never had anybody go, nah, you know, I want you to stick around. And the only time that's going to be different is if it's a business. Yeah, businesses are not going to want you taking their computers out. So you're basically going to go there. They're used to paying an hourly rate. And so for businesses, it's 100% hourly. And you can break that up into however you want. If you want to do it in half-hour increments, and that's how you want to charge, some people will do it that way. Some people, it's an hour to hour, you know. If you go over that first hour, it's hour number two. If you go over that hour, it's hour number three, and so on and so forth. So some people do it in 15-minute increments. You kind of have to depend on what you feel comfortable with doing. You know, I think a half hour is more than fair, you know, as far as charging for, you know, businesses on site. And then the other thing you were talking about was the TechNibble computer business kit is one of the things I bought a long time ago when I first started my business back in 2010. It's been through three reiterations, and I bought all three because it is the number one thing that has helped me in my business keep all my stuff straight. And don't tell anybody out there, but I still use an Excel spreadsheet from there, and that's how I do my financing. I just haven't in the reason, you know, a lot of people go, seriously? And I'm like, I just have not taken the time. Let's face it. As a technician, it is fun to learn, and it sucks to learn. Learn new things, I should say. It's just something else I have to learn with QuickBooks or, you know, whatever accounting software out there. And I've used different ones over the years, but, yeah. So, anyways, but I'm still using their contracts. I kind of redid their contracts because they give it to you in a Word format. The latest one has PDFs, so you can have it on your smartphone or tablet. And you can have, here's the thing, guys, and I'm guilty of this, you can have your checklist on your smartphone, which I don't do. So with that being said, it's one of those things that I will definitely implement into my business. And here's the thing, what's beautiful about that, if you are creating those checklists, everybody's has got a smartphone, right? So a lot of times you can give those to a technician and say, okay, you have your PDF checklist, just, you know, check them off as you go. I'm a little old school. I think if you have 5 computers sitting on a bench and you have different employees working for you, I still think it's better to have a piece of paper taped to it that you can basically physically, you know, sign off on. But if you can figure out a way to do it the other way, or if one technician is going to, you know, take that computer from point A all the way to the end and you know that for sure, you know, PDF is, you know, definitely the way to go. I think that was it. That was it of the two questions there, right?
Yeah, I think so.
The two that we missed. Okay.
Looks like we have a couple more.
Okay.
And we're almost out of time here, so if you guys have any last questions, submit them now, and we'll get to them. Aaron asks, thinking about offering a free 1-hour workshop for retirement or assisted living communities to introduce myself and build my client list. Thoughts or advice?
That, you know, that's a great option. I will tell you that, you know, Kerry Holzman from Tech Vets is basically, that's kind of what he's built his business on. He's in Arizona and is in a huge retirement community. And that's basically, you know, he charges a flat rate, I think, of $125. And he actually builds computers, which is most of his business. And you know what? He builds it, and he also goes to these, you know, senior centers and different community centers to teach people about, you know, scams or, you know, just how to better use your computer. And I think that's great. Anytime that you can give free information, like we were talking about earlier on Facebook or whatever, and if you want to do it live, that's, I think that's perfect, because not only that, what ended up happening with him is he would go to these things just to share information, and he wouldn't bring his business cards with him. But after he was done with his seminar, everybody liked what he had said, and they kept coming up to him. Do you have a business card? Do you have a business card? Do you have a business card? You know, it's not something he pushed, but it's just something that they were like, hey, we like this guy. He's here helping us out. I'm going to get a business card, because if I need something fixed on my computer, I'm going to call him. So I think that's a great way to do that type of business.
Nice. Lastly, Derek asks, reveal some good prices on various services. I've always worked from home, and the advantages are huge.
Reveal some prices on various services. I'm not sure exactly what, are you talking about prices that I charge or prices on services that we use in the business? Aaron, what's his name again? Kerry Holzman. Him and Mike Smith from the Mike Tech Show actually do Tech Vets.
Yeah, Derek says either. So,
As far as my service prices, I think I've kind of, you know, revealed, you know, I do, like I said, $89 flat for most fixes. If you bring it to me, if I go out, it's $89 plus probably a $40 trip charge. You know, screens generally, you know, they're right around $149. You know, I charge I charge $79 for, you know, for the screen replacement. And, you know, parts are usually, you know, around $70. I might pay $50, but, you know, so I make a little bit of money on parts there. I don't charge a whole lot extra on the parts. I try to keep the parts, you know, I charge a little bit because of shipping, handling, the time to look it up, you know, the time to get, you know, to get the parts in and all that kind of stuff. So I add a little bit to it. I know there's other people that, you know, they have a flat rate of adding 30% to their parts. I'm not that person. I just kind of figure out what it is I want to make on that repair and how much time is it going to take me to do it. You know, quite honestly, screen replacements for your mainstream laptops is 20 minutes, and that's 10 minutes to basically pull the screen off, look at the back, order the part, and when a part comes in, it's another 10 minutes to basically put that other screen in and test it out and call the customer up and go, here you go. So I love, you know, things like screen replacements. You know, laptop DC jack replacements. Back in the day when you had to solder everyone onto a board because they didn't have the little plug-in on or a little daughter board that plugged into the main motherboard, you know, you had to desolder it, put a new one in. You know, the parts were fairly cheap. I've always charged, I used to charge $99. Now I charge $125 for a laptop, you know, DC jack replacement. Motherboard replacements, you know, $100, you know, plus parts, you know, different things like that. Memory installation, $20, you know, plus whatever the memory costs. Custom computer builds, $199. You know, because not only, and it's not just about putting the computer together. If you're doing a custom computer build, a lot of times you are researching the stuff to buy and, you know, to get the customer whatever it is they're trying to do, whether it's playing a video game or, you know, doing their stocks. And so that takes time to research, and so that's just part of the cost. You know, I love building computers, and quite honestly, if I could build computers all day long, I would do that. But, there seems to be a lot more that need to be repaired versus people that want actually custom built computers at this point. I do charge, reinstallation of Windows with a data transfer, you know, $125. You know, if I set up a new computer, which I encourage people to do because people always set them up wrong, it's $49. You know, just a data transfer. I'm just pulling information off, putting it onto, you know, whatever their medium is, another hard drive or a USB flash drive. That's $50. You know, setting up a backup program, $39. You know, installing things like Microsoft Office, $25. So those are just some of my prices. And those, you know what, I've adjusted those over time depending on, you know, kind of what I'm doing and kind of if I feel that I'm spending too much time on something, you know, I want to, what I've always figured out in my business is what I want to make per hour. And so that's the way I try to gauge it. So with parts and labor, I try to make it so that I'm happy with my hourly rate. Plus, you know, all the other things, whether it be advertising or phone service and stuff like that. So you've got to count all that stuff in there. And I think from that standpoint, a lot of us are still probably charging a bit low. I think you can definitely bring that up. But again, you have to feel where you're comfortable at. Again, this is not my full-time job. This is a part-time job for me. It's something I really enjoy, and it will be my retirement job where I will definitely have to make some drastic changes to my business, but it's a work in progress. So I hope that helps with some of the information of, you know, just some of the prices that I, you know, and I will tell everybody out there, as far as in the industry, I'm a very open book. I don't really try to hide anything. I will let you guys, if you guys ask me a point blank question, I'll answer it to the best of my ability of what I do, of what has worked, of what hasn't worked, those types of things. So, you know, a lot of people want to be secretive about that stuff. It doesn't really matter to me. I tell people all the time, to be honest with you, I'm too old to care. You know, I just want to help people out there, and that's, you know, that's why we do things like this, to hopefully, if not giving you the straight answer, at least sparking some, you know, sparking your brain to move in a direction where you can take that information and do something with it.
Great. Thank you, Jeff. Jesse asks, what do you tell customers that insist you have their computer done in one day and refuse to let you work on it in a timely manner?
Oh, that's a perfect question. So a lot of times here's a way you can you know, avoid that or actually make some more money. That's fine. That will be a I can't remember what they call it. I don't want to say a supercharge, but it basically, instead of 89, yeah, we can have it done today, no problem. That'll be 189. Well, they call that a, you know, I can't remember that. There's a terminology, and I've lost it off the top of my head. You know, faster service. You know, you want that fast labor, turn around one day. Yeah, we can do that, no problem. There'll be an extra charge for that. It's $100.
Yeah, I think that you can. What we used to do at a repair shop that I was at is we called it, I want to say, like an emergency service or like a rush service or something. If you standardize that and you say, well, yeah, sure, we can have it back for you the same day, but you're going to have to get the rush service, then it's more of like they're making a decision about whether they want it or not, and it's not on you. It's not like you're the bad guy. You're providing them the option, and they get it.
Right.
Or they don't.
Exactly. It, what you'll find out is a lot of times that those people that really wanted that computer back that day, at $100, it's not that important for them to get back that day.
Right.
That's just what you'll find. No, it's not $100 worth of importance for me to get that back today. Take your time.
Yeah, and that kind of gets you off the hook as well. Or you get $100 extra. So
exactly. And, you know, and a lot of times for those people that are working part-time in this business, if you know, if somebody's going to give me $189 for doing, you know, a rush labor job, you know, at that point, I'd probably even take the day off work and just stay home and finish the job. So, you know, you may or may not have those options. I don't know. But that's, you know, if somebody's willing to pay me extra, you know, outside of what I'm normally doing, then, yeah, hey, no problem. I'll do that. I'd rather do that than go to my full-time job anyways. So something to think about.
Awesome. Well, this has been really helpful. Does anybody have any last-minute questions? We can do one question more. If not, this has been really helpful, and I really appreciate you coming on, Jeff, and I'm sure it'll be helpful for everybody who wasn't able to attend as well.
Well, I thank you for, you know, inviting me to come out and, you know, just share again in the community and so that, you know, more people can know about that there are people out here that are trying to help, you know, kind of bridge that gap. And you know, so we're not all islands by ourselves just kind of hanging out. Hopefully we can, you know, keep the community and stuff going and grow it to a point where, you know, basically what we're doing is we're all helping each other because, let's face it, in this internet age, we're talking to people all over the world, and it's fascinating to talk to people on the other side of the globe and see what they do compared to what we do here, or, you know, people on the West Coast, East Coast, you know, in the middle of the States or whatever, or in Hawaii, you know. It's fascinating to me because everybody's got, lives in a different area. Sometimes you charge more, sometimes you charge less, but it always sparks ideas in me to learn what other people are doing. Because then I can always further my business. Maybe I don't agree with, you know, with what they're doing, which, you know, not everybody's going to agree with the way that I do business, and that's fine. But you can take something from that and, you know, gain some knowledge and keep moving forward. So I definitely appreciate you having me come out. This was fun. I had fun sitting here answering questions. For a lot of you that don't know, podcasting takes a lot of effort when it comes to technical things on my side, and so for me to sit back in a webinar like this and basically answer questions and just talk, which I love to do, it's been great. So I definitely appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah, no worries. And on that note, how can people learn more about you and PodNuts?
Well, basically what I would do is, you know, we have several shows over on PodNuts. I do three of them over there, and it's www.podnuts.com. And, you know, I do PodNuts, the Computer Repair Podcast, every Sunday live at 4 p.m. Eastern. And you can check that out over at podnuts.com/live if you want to watch that live. And also, we also have a call-in number that you can call in. You can add to the conversation. You can basically, you know, call in and ask a question on the fly. You know, we do this every single Sunday, except for if you know, we're taking Mother's Day off and stuff like that. But for the most part, we're there every Sunday, and we're there for you guys, and we're there just to share information. You know, the other show I do is PodNuts Daily, and if you are a technician or a computer repair business owner, feel free to contact me over at podnutsdaily@podnuts.com, and you guys can basically, you know, come on a show and share what you're doing in your business, what's working for you, what's not working for you, and, you know, help some other people out that listen to that show. The other show I do is called My Hard Drive Died. And that's with Scott Moulton, who is the hard drive guru and knows all things about hard drives, forensics, and all kinds of stuff. So you can check that out over there. And if anybody wants to, you know, personally get in contact with me, like I said, there's a couple email addresses for PodNuts Daily at podnutsdaily@podnuts.com. You have podnuts@podnuts.com for the main show. If you want to, you know, contact me personally, you can contact me personally at jeff@technutpc.com. And, you know, that you can get information there. And, yeah, I'm more than willing to help. I do answer all my emails. It might not be, you know, within a few days, but it will get answered sometime within that week when you send an email. So, and if you ever ask a question or anything like that and you don't receive an email back, number one, check your spam filter. And number two, you know, let me know you got the email because that way I know that, you know, you got it and hopefully it was a help to you.
Awesome. Well, thank you, everybody, for attending. And, Jeff, thanks again. Let us know if you have any questions. And Jeff gave you his email, but if you need to reach me, I will put my email down at the chat box there at ian@repairtechsolutions.com. Feel free to get in touch if you think of anything after the show. And thanks, guys.
Thank you.
All right. Have a good one.